Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May 22, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the meaning of emptiness within the Buddha's teachings, to be empty of ignorance. The Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that initiates the process of ongoing conceit or eye-making, resulting in confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this week, all the classes will be on emptiness and the Buddha's meaning on emptiness, and by necessity, I'll point out the differences in different schools' application of mindfulness. And I know that I get some people uncomfortable when I point out the differences between what has developed and what the Buddha taught, and I understand that. I don't hear it so much from this Sangha, but I do hear it from other people online. And the only reason I do this is not to denigrate or diminish any other practice, but simply to point out the brilliance of an awakened human being and his fearless and independent thinking that developed from his awakening. And understanding and coming through his own confusion in the spiritual soup that was so common during his time and is just as prevalent today. And again, it may seem like a fine line between denigration and simply respecting the teachings of an awakened human being, but it's the latter. As we talked a little bit on retreat, the Buddha taught via negativa, meaning he pointed out the problem, the negative aspect, what has developed from ignorance, so that we could enjoy the positive, so that we can enjoy awakening. And these suttas that I'll refer to this week point to a very basic understanding of what the Buddha's application of mindfulness is to be mindful of what is present, but it's equally important to be mindful of what is not present. And so as we begin our Dhamma practice, being mindful of what is present is being mindful of ignorance and the remnants of ignorance, and at the same time being mindful of what is not present. At that point, true wisdom. And as we start developing the Dhamma, that perspective shifts, and eventually what happens is we become mindful of the presence of profound wisdom married with true compassion and the emptiness of any remnant of ignorance. And that type of mindfulness is required, as we've learned through dependent origination, if we're going to awaken. We have to be willing to put a phrase on it. We have to be willing to confront our demons, meaning to confront our wrong views, if we're going to establish right view. And that means an examination of them independently and fearlessly of any other thought. If you read this article, you realize it's a very, very long article with a lot of commentary. I'm hoping to get to most of the sutta itself, but as was pointed out to me very skillfully, that my commentary is necessary too in order to make this clear. So I'm beginning to read from the article, probably about two-thirds of the way into my introduction, my commentary, because I'll cover it, and this last really synopsizes what the rest of it is. Boy, that was a sloppy introduction, but let me get to it now.
The introduction to the introduction.
Yeah. And again, just to qualify it and put it in the right context. For those new to Buddhism or anyone confused, these are my words, obviously. For those new to Buddhism or anyone confused by modern dharmas, it is important to recognize and acknowledge these significant differences so that the purpose and foundation of any Buddhist practice is clearly understood. There is nothing skillful in attempting to reconcile the many contradictory forms of modern Buddhism into one hybridized individual or group Buddhist practice when a misapplication or ignorance of Four Noble Truths is the result. Of course, everything the Buddha taught was in the context of Four Noble Truths. Continued ignorance only continues ignorance. The modern conceptual applications of emptiness are themselves originating in ignorance of dependent origination. Often, the Paticca Samuppada Sutta is altered or completely ignored in order to allow for the modern concepts of interdependence, interconnectedness, and interbeing. It is this initial ignorance of dependent origination that allows for the contradictory modern applications of emptiness in the many modern contradictory Buddhist practices. This modern confusing doctrine hopes to show that all things, including all human beings, are infinitely interdependent, constantly interconnected, and can only thrive through interbeing. It is this amorphous and interdependent soup that somehow reconciles in a doctrine of emptiness. In other words, all things are interdependent, interconnected, and interbe, and so are empty of a separate existence. Simple physics shows that there are elements common to all physical objects. The commonality of physical elements does not resolve the problem of dukkha occurring from individual craving or clinging to impermanent wrong views and experiences. Resolving dukkha and physical elemental commonality have no useful relationship as far as awakening is concerned. Of course, the Buddha did not teach to see oneself in everything and to see everything as oneself. This just encourages clinging and maintaining, which we know is the primary problem. The Buddha taught that everything in the phenomenal world is discrete and carries the three marks of existence. The Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that the common human problem of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking arises from ignorance, not from a lack of connection. Greed or craving or desire, aversion or hatred, and deluded thinking are known as the three defilements common to unawakened human beings, those lacking the full maturity that is developed through gaining understanding of Four Noble Truths. All things in the phenomenal world carry the three marks of existence. For the 45 years of his teaching career, the Buddha consistently taught that the five clinging aggregates, what is perceived as a self, are in nature impermanent. And as we learned on the retreat, what is impermanent cannot constitute a self. What's the one thought?
I'm sorry,
I should put that in perspective. The little meme, if I can use the word, and maybe it doesn't even fix, I'm not quite sure what that means, on retreat was, what is the one thought that always inclines the mind towards awakening? And that one thought, no matter what we're caught up in our lives, is, this is not me, and its variance. This is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. And every time we feel like we're agitated or maybe too happy, just remind yourself, depersonalize the situation. This is not me, this is not mine. The Buddha continues, what is impermanent, this is dukkha, unsatisfactory. Whatever is dukkha, that is without atta, meaning anatta. The Buddha is without a permanent self. What is without self, that is not mine, that I am not, this is not myself. Thus should it be seen by perfect wisdom as it really is. Who sees by perfect wisdom as it really is, his mind, not grasping, is detached from the taints, meaning the three defilements. He is now liberated. My words, grasping after concepts that seek to establish a self in an environment of emptiness or nothingness, or in an inherent inner Buddha nature or Buddhahood, is still grasping and is rooted in ignorance. The Buddha did not teach an empty nature of the phenomenal world, implying that nothing actually exists. He taught that nothing exists that should be used to establish or maintain a permanent substantial self through clinging self-referential views to objects, events, views, and ideas. Rather than attempt to establish a self in everything, meaning clinging to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, or to crave for the establishment of self in discrete impermanent phenomena or conceptual dharmas, both extreme views, the Buddha taught emptiness as a way of describing that followers of his Dhamma should be empty of clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas, and should not attach a notion of self onto or into the impermanent phenomenal world. And again, that comes back to being mindful of what is present and be mindful of what is not present. Ultimately, emptiness refers to having a mind that is empty of any internal disturbance caused by self-referential clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas, including external identification with Buddhist practices that were never taught by the Buddha. Emptiness, as emptiness relates to the Buddha's teachings, is mostly a verb rather than a noun. It is skillful in a sense to see emptiness as emptying a glass of dirty water rather than seeing emptiness as a grand cosmic environment to aspire to or as the definition of an awakened self. The Buddha taught to empty oneself of craving and clinging and to empty the world of self-referential clinging views, to empty oneself of that initial ignorance. The Buddha, having awakened to dependent origination, taught an eightfold path to end ignorance and bring an end to craving for and clinging to all things interconnected or with me, or that all things I am interdependent on, or all things that I am interbeing with. So this is the beginning of the Kulasanatta Sutta, and I probably won't get through the whole thing tonight. It's a rather kula, as I was telling David. Kula means lesser, and maha means greater. And I also pointed out that sometimes that's not always true. The Kulasanatta Sutta is much, much longer than the Mahasanatta Sutta. And it really has to do, I mean, it does refer to the length, but it also has to do with its inclusion in the different books of the Pali Canon.
Maybe there's more emptiness in it.
Pardon me?
So maybe there's just more emptiness in the Kula.
That's right. There is. So we'll see how far I get to it. And then, again, the classes this week will all conclude with these first two suttas. I'm not going to get into the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta this week because we just covered it on retreat. The Buddha was at Savatthi in the Eastern Monastery, a local palace. The Buddha's chief attendant and cousin, Ananda, returning from seclusion, asked the Buddha, "On one occasion I heard you say, 'I now remain fully dwelling in the quality of mind, in emptiness.' Did I hear this correctly? Did I learn this correctly? Did I remember this correctly?" The Buddha replied, "Yes, Ananda, you heard that correctly, you learned it correctly, and you remembered it correctly. Now as before, I remain fully dwelling in emptiness." Before, meaning he's talking about post his awakening. "Just as this palace is empty of elephants and cattle and empty of gold or silver, empty of assemblies of women and men, and there is only this non-emptiness of the community of monks." So this can be a little bit confusing until we get through the entire sutta. The Buddha's talking about, in that sentence there, also being mindful of what's present and being mindful of what's not present. "Even so, Ananda, when distracted by the perception of the village, not being distracted by the perception of a human being, there is only mindfulness of a wilderness with no distractions to what is not present." In other words, an awakened human being is not distracted by the people and events of his life. There is only the wilderness of a peaceful mind resting in equanimity. Wilderness is metaphor for a self, a point of reference that is no longer clinging to or craving for self-referential existence. It also means that there is no discursive or speculative thought. The mind takes pleasure and finds, again, back to the Buddha's words, the mind takes pleasure and satisfaction in being mindful of the wilderness. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the wilderness. And again, wilderness is simply perception of a mind empty of wrong views. I'll skip over my commentary. This subheading is called Emptiness of the Perception of the Village. And the village is, well, let me just say it. It is then understood that whatever disturbances that would arise from being distracted by the things of the village are no longer present. Whatever disturbances that would arise from being distracted by the perception of a permanent human being are no longer present. There is only the single-minded, meaning well-concentrated, the only single-minded focus based on the mindfulness of the wilderness, mindfulness of what is not present and mindful of what is present, your own awakened mind. The Buddha is referring to himself here, remember. It is understood that this perception is empty of the distraction of the things of the village. And the village is our immediate surroundings that the Buddha is referring to. And it's not necessarily confined to a physical space that you are. In other words, it's not within 5 miles of where I'm sitting. It's our local perception. And you'll see how the Buddha builds that perception from what we're only usually mindful of locally and expands it out gradually into including all of creation. There is only this non-emptiness of the perception of the wilderness. It is seen as being empty of what is not there, meaning empty of disturbance by external self-identification, again, empty of ignorance. What is present is seen as there is only this. This is the entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure. is this getting rather confusing?
Challenging.
It'll hopefully I'll make it clear, or the words will make it clear. But you're not getting lost in this?
Not
enough to be a distraction. The next subheading is emptiness of the perception of earth. We're expanding our experience of emptiness. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings falls away. Dispassionate mindfulness of the earth arises. That's metaphor for dispassionate spaciousness of our thinking increasing. This mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the perception of earth without any self-referential views. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of earth. Just as a bull's hide is stretched free of wrinkles with many stakes, a metaphorical reference to mindfulness, free of distraction to the ridges and the hollows, the rivers and the oceans, the trees and the stumps and brambles, the craggy irregularities of the earth, non-distraction based solely on the perception of the earth, meaning free of discriminating thoughts to those things that just described. I like this stump, I don't like that stump. I love this river, that one doesn't do it for me. That's what the Buddha's referring to, clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas. Emptiness is being free of that clinging, free of ignorance that would drive one to cling to that. It is now understood that this perception is empty of a permanent, substantial human being, empty of the perception of a wilderness. Now there is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the earth. Do you see how this developing wisdom is now expanding in spaciousness and taking in and understanding more of the emptiness, beginning with the local environment and now expanding it out to include metaphorically the earth, a greater expansion of mindfulness? Liz?
John, does this have to do with what we talked about on retreat, the idea of, you know, a life of clinging and craving sits within this continuous two?
Yes.
And that life exists, we're missing everything that that is existing outside of this two.
Liz, I'm sorry, I just, while I was pouring water on myself, I was distracted. A lack of concentration. Could you say that again, please?
I was just saying that, is this the same thing that we're talking about on the retreat, where clinging, craving allows us to live inside this little sort of tube, and we joked around calling it the me tube instead of you tube. But there's this tube of our existence based on what we're clinging and craving to, when in fact there's this whole other spaciousness outside of that tube that we're missing.
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. The metaphor, and it's not only a metaphor, it's an actual experience of developing spaciousness, shows that this me tube, these being stuck in self-referential views is often referred to by the Buddha as a constricting place. And we've all felt that. It's a tightening of our mind, and our mind just can't escape it.
Like blinders on a horse.
Yes, because we're stuck. Our minds can because we're attached to and clinging to ignorant views, and we're using those views to describe ourselves. We can't escape it. We've set ourselves in this cage, in this boundary of wrong views. And we don't recognize it because we're caught in the same feedback loop that the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta. It constantly reaffirms itself. How does it do it? It does it. I'm going
to
leave that.
For you to say.
It does it by creating these incredibly subtle and intricate but powerful strategies to ignore its own ignorance. And that's exactly what the Buddha is referring to here in describing his independent and fearless understanding of the way things are, rather than attaching himself to the common beliefs and seeing which views support his wrong views and calling it Dharma practice. Using that term independent, you remember in the Kula Sakaka Sutta how the Buddha concludes that and calls this, and it's an independent and fearless Dhamma. Remember what we learned on retreat and we've been learning here, that desire drives fear, which results in suffering. That's the same thing. Desire for self-referential existence continues fear, whether we acknowledge it or not. And that's the underlying suffering described as dukkha occurs. And so how do we extricate ourselves? The Buddha is showing us. He's teaching us how to empty ourselves of that very ignorance so that we can live free and liberated, so that our minds can crack through the boundaries of ignorance and literally live free within a mind, a body united with its mind. A body that is stuck on self-referential views is not in its body. It's stuck in these views that insist that you not be in a body. Another way of saying that is to be present of, to be mindful of what is present. What is the most important thing to be mindful of that is present?
The
breath in the body. How the Buddha starts his instructions on meditation, to be mindful of the breath in the body, it immediately brings us in. A mind that is distracted by ignorance is always outside of its body, even though it will never admit it, because it needs to continue to play that magician's trick that we talked about.
The eye making comes before the sensation of breathing in the body in most cases.
Yes. And another word that I don't know why I didn't use it on retreat, but it's just as useful a word to some people, is selfing. It's ongoing selfing. It takes just about all the effort we have to maintain eye making, to maintain selfing. And it creates tremendous stress and tension in our lives, and it keeps us full of ignorant views.
And the illustration that Jen used was, she described it as the effort to maintain these strategies to maintain ignorance is going on here, and meanwhile you can't see all of this that's actually happening in life because you're so focused on the ignorance and maintaining the ignorance in this small, non-spacious experience.
Yes.
She said it way back, but something like that.
She said it beautifully, and it just points to the incredible effort and distraction that comes from maintaining ignorance. It literally takes all we have. It literally does. And when we let go of all that effort, putting all we have into maintaining ignorance, then we become all that we are.
And putting that effort toward developing your practice.
Yeah, but isn't it interesting that, maybe this is a little too subtle to just throw out there, but you know I'm going to do it anyway. The difficulties that people have in initiating and maintaining a Dhamma practice is just that trying to maintain, whether it's, and usually it is kind of subconsciously, trying to maintain ignorant views while trying to incorporate views rooted in wisdom. It can't be done. One must empty oneself, create space in the vessel, empty the dirty glass before clean water can flow in. Wisdom and ignorance cannot coincide within the same mind, although as we learn that one thought can have two different aspects to it, we can take that mind that is rooted in ignorance and develop profound wisdom within that same, within a mind that is initially rooted in ignorance. And that is precisely why we need an Eightfold Path to guide us through that, because without it, ignorance will prevail. It's just too strong to overcome. And that's the real brilliance of what the Buddha awakened to. Remember, upon his awakening, he didn't just jump off his cushion and start preaching to the world. He then considered, and again, the time frame is rather speculative, but I would say about 2 weeks from reading the suttas, and some of them say about 2 weeks. He seriously considered for 2 more weeks post his awakening, how am I going to teach this? Knowing what I know, the common human problem of ignorance, how can I pierce that veil of ignorance, knowing how strong and powerful it is, even though, as we learn, it's ultimately like a glob of foam. There's no real substance except that we insist on maintaining it. How can I teach that? What can I do? How can I take people's minds rooted in deluded thinking and give them something that any human being can use if they engage in it wholeheartedly to recognize what is present and what is not present, to turn those views around. And so he gave us an Eightfold Path. So now we're getting into emptiness of the perception of the infinitude of space. Again, long words, and in the infinitude of space is not something we usually would even think of or maybe even say. But he's taking these teachings and applying them to, again, common practices of his time. Remember, the Buddha studied with Alaraka Lama and Udaka Ramaputta, two of the most advanced spiritual teachers of the Buddha time, Buddha's time, and those teachings are very similar to what's occurring now. Alaraka Lama taught, ultimately his the highest form of his teaching was to enter into the perception of nothingness or not nothingness, and Udaka Ramaputta taught to enter into the space of perception or non-perception, both similar, and the Buddha mastered those very quickly and rejected them both. His words were, these are ignoble, base, and hurtful, they don't lead to the goal. So he continued to study. And in the Anapanasati Sutta and the Satipatthana Sutta, he mentions those. As he's mentioning all the other more base ideas, to include them as these seemingly higher developments are just another distraction. And to simply, what do? When we recognize ignorance, we simply abandon it.
And there's still selfing in there.
There's still self. All it is trying to, what the Buddha realized, now I'm establishing myself in a realm of nothingness or not nothingness, which is kind of the same as emptiness, isn't it? Or perception or not perception.
Sounds like that was sort of like a power thing too, because they were putting the bar so high because there's no, you can't really achieve that.
Yeah, because it's really not based in reality.
It doesn't, yeah.
Yeah.
And so by keep moving the goalpost, people had to keep engaging more and more, thinking that there was this thing that was so valued and hard to achieve, and what an achievement if you get there. And yet it was like the horizon, you just never get there.
It's the carrot on a stick, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so if you can establish yourself as a teacher of this great wisdom who understands nothingness and not nothingness or all the other things, then you're always having students that are grasping after you, aren't they?
Mm-hmm, right.
Which is the continual, again, that's why you've heard me say often, to misrepresent the Dhamma to me is the cruelest thing anybody can do, because it's the carrot on a stick. You're simply leading people along in ignorance.
That's actually easier for people.
Well, of course it is. It mollifies. It's palliative.
It's out there. You'll never get it. It's lifetimes. It's millions of lifetimes.
And isn't that the claim is?
So keep going. Versus the hard work of what the Buddha's challenging you with.
Yeah.
It also makes.
You actually have to do something.
You have to do something.
It also makes those teachers sort of like deities, because they've achieved this thing.
Apparently.
Can't be achieved.
Which is
yeah.
And so
if I can tell you, I know something, I know the one thought, I know something that you don't, but if you follow me, maybe you can.
Yeah.
Again, it's just sleight of hand, isn't it? It's just a magician's trick. And so, like a magician, they'll have you looking over here, but what's happening is here. You know, or the Wizard of Oz. Don't look at the man behind the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
Because you might find that, you know, it's just an ordinary guy who don't really know that much. Yeah, as opposed to how the Buddha carried himself. He never elevated himself above humanity. In fact, he continually insisted that you see me as a man who simply understands, who's developed right view. And if you understand that, and then I can tell you, I'm not, you know, as a Buddha, then I can show you how to do it. But if you see me, and he knew this, if you saw me as a god or a deity, there's never a point of connection. Remember, we talked about how important it is to meet people where they are. Well, the Buddha understood that at such a profound level. And he continually walked around in rags with one bowl like everyone else. And then when it was time to teach the Dhamma, he sat down and he taught it as a human being, as one of the Sangha. I won't get into that. Emptiness of the perception of the infinitude of space. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth falls away. We're expanding the diminishing of self-referential views now. This passionate mindfulness of the dimension of the infinitude of space arises. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction. And again, I have to qualify this. The Buddha is not teaching this as a progression of development, meaning that we should develop an understanding of an experience of the infinitude of space. He's pointing out that these common practices don't get you there. They're just steps along the way, and ultimately we have to get to the point that maybe I'll get to tonight. Mm-hmm. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of the infinitude of space. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space. It is now understood that whatever disturbances that would arise based on the perception of wilderness or human beings or of the earth do not arise. The mind is empty of these perceptions. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space. That last line, there's still some remnants of ignorance, isn't it? Even though we're developing through this. And again, the Buddha is not teaching progression, meaning a developing heightened awareness. He's simply describing common qualities of mind that are rooted in ignorance. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. This is further entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure. In other words, you have to go through these things that you have attached yourself to, recognizing that they're not it, and let them go. Emptiness of the perception of the infinitude of consciousness. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth and of the dimension of the infinitude of space falls away. We're losing connection and creating a personal experience of even that now. This passionate mindfulness of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness arises. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. It is now understood that whatever disturbances that would arise based on the perception of wilderness or human beings or of the earth or of the dimension of the infinitude of space do not arise. We're slowly eliminating wrong views rooted in ignorance. And so we cease creating these scenarios for repositories of self or continued selfing or I-making. There is only the non-emptiness, a remnant of ignorance is still here. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. We're slowly transitioning from that mind that is initially mindful of being of what is present as ignorance towards a mind that is developing perception of what is not there, and now developing elements of wisdom. Being mindful that wisdom is now developing and ignorance is decreasing. Emptiness of the perception of the dimension of nothingness. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth and of the dimension of the infinitude of space and of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness falls away. Now, you remember most of it, as we go through dependent origination, I always point out that when we're using the word consciousness, the common application is, oh, that's that grand consciousness that we all want to be a part of, this great dawning of this great new consciousness. The Buddha is referring to here as ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. So there's nothing, we're not developing a great awareness, we're simply recognizing what is present and what is not present. This passionate mindfulness of the dimension of nothingness arises. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of nothingness. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of nothingness. He's describing the trap of attaining these seemingly higher states of consciousness and clearly describing them, they're just a trap. There's no attainment here. It seems like we're developing something. We might even have an experience of a calm and peaceful mind while we've created this scenario rooted in ignorance. It feels comfortable. But so does a cold pot of water to a lobster until you turn up the heat. It feels good, it feels familiar, but it's still an establishment of continued eye-making.
It's a huge one
because now we can call on others and say, you know, I've had this experience, and it becomes a common experience, and through our association, it gives validity to it. It feels like we're doing something because everyone else around us is doing the same thing. And claiming that this experience, whatever it might be, because remember, we're giving this reality based on our own views, but we're saying, I'm achieving something. I've attained the development of neither perception nor non-perception. Wow. But an awakened human being says, it's not it. It's just another trap. And he says of that, it is now understood that whatever disturbances that would arise based on the perception of wilderness or human beings or of the earth or the dimension of the infinitude of space or the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness do not arise. The mind is empty. See, we first have to have the experience of what our ignorance has taken us to, our wrong views has taken us to, before we can abandon it. And once we can abandon it, once we abandon it, they do not arise. The mind is empty of these perceptions. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of nothingness. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. This is further entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted as pure. And pure, the Buddha is describing very clearly and in fairly minute detail how we go from ignorance and the progression towards awakening. And he's also subtly cautioning us to not see any achievement until we get to the goal, to not rest on our laurels. There's more to do. And the Eightfold Path, particularly right effort, continues to guide us. Because if we remember right effort and its concordant aspect of the Eightfold Path, right intention, we'll never rest on our laurels, because we'll remember the sutta, or at least understand that this is, when I'm in this grand space of perception or non-perception, this is fabricated. And as we know, fabrications require ignorance to form, don't they? And an awakened human being knows what is fabricated and what is not fabricated. How do we do that? Because we're mindful of what's present and what is not present. Emptiness of the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Furthermore, Ananda, as concentration increases within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the perception of wilderness and of human beings and of the earth and of the dimension of the infinitude of space and of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness and of the dimension of nothingness falls away. We don't have to do anything except recognize it and abandon it with reference to the Eightfold Path. Dispassionate mindfulness of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception arises. The mind takes pleasure and finds satisfaction in being mindful of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. The mind quiets and delights in the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. It is now understood that whatever disturbances that would arise based on the perception of wilderness or of human beings or of the earth or the dimension of the infinitude of space or of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness or of the dimension of nothingness do not arise. The mind is empty of these perceptions. There is only the non-emptiness of the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Simply put, there's still a shred of ignorance left. And we know it because we're following the practice the way it's meant to. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. This is further entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure. Released from all fabricated views, true emptiness. I shouldn't say true emptiness, emptiness. Finally, Ananda, having abandoned the perceptions of the dimensions of nothingness and the perception of the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, one abides in single-minded concentration. Why? Why and how do we abide in single-minded concentration? Because we've left everything that would distract us. And we've done it in a purposeful and intentional way through our own efforts. This is what the Buddha means when he says that he is a rightly self-awakened one, and he teaches us how to become rightly self-awakened. Single-minded concentration, free of self-referential views. The quality of mind is regarded as empty of what is not there. We know what we've left behind. We know that we're extricating ourselves from the feedback loop, not because we're taking this on faith, because we're having a direct experience as the Buddha did. This is a satisfied and pleasant abiding. And that's enough for a mind that's not always grasping, isn't it? The mind quiets and is gratified in single-minded concentration, free of self-referential views. It is understood that this single-minded concentration, free of self-reference, is fabricated and formed through thought. This is an important thing. The problem is rooted in our thinking, and so the solution takes place in our thinking. But now it is thinking, the breath in the body. It is thinking and with a mind that is united, unified with its body.
Could you go over that last...
Go back to the beginning of this?
The last 2 seconds.
Beginning with, it is understood?
Mm-hmm.
It is understood that... It is understood that this single-minded concentration, free of self-reference, is fabricated and formed through thought. Was that the line?
Yeah.
Having abandoned all self-referential views, was it this fabricated? We're using, remember how the Buddha talked about in the Kakkayanagata Sutta, he first described dependent origination resulting in ignorance, and then he took us in reverse order.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's referring to. So a mind that is yet to be fully awakened, full human maturity, is still fabricated. But the brilliance of the Buddha, of an awakened human being, is being able to use a fabricated mind, a mind rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, and turning that mind. One thought can have two different meanings, can head in two different directions. He's taking that mind rooted in ignorance. He's meeting it where that mind is. We meet people where they are, or the nothing works. In this case, the Dhamma, he's meeting us in our deluded state, taking us by the hand through the Eightfold Path and guiding us towards awakening. How else could it be? The Buddha understood, I have to meet people where they are. I can't expect them to meet me where I am. Right? True compassion married with wisdom. He wasn't just an example, an arrogant example of what I think an awakened human being is. He came down, that's not the right word, he stayed as a human being so he could reach all human beings. Having abandoned all self-referential views, it is understood that whatever is fabricated and formed through thought is impermanent and subject to cessation. Remember how Kandana awakened when he understood conditioning and impermanence. Now this mind is right there. It's ready to understand the impermanence of all things. Because it's made space, it's eliminated all the things that were blocking it up until that point of true understanding. Whatever is fabricated and formed through thought is impermanent and subject to cessation. What did Kandana say? All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. He got all of this in that one first sutta, but of course he's been practicing like the Buddha did for all those years too. The
third noble truth, cessation of stress is experienced.
Yes, yes.
Described.
Understanding the impermanent nature of all fabrications, the mind is just about there. The mind is released from the stress of sensuality, from the stress of becoming, eye-making, and from the stress of ignorance. It is understood that birth of further ignorant views has ended. The integrated life, meaning integrated with the Eightfold Path, has been lived. The path is complete. There is nothing left clinging to the world. It is understood that whatever disturbances that arose from the stress of sensuality, from the stress of becoming, from the stress of ignorance, are no longer present. It is understood. We know we are mindful of what is present and what is no longer present. There is now only the minor disturbance connected to the sixth sense base that is dependent on the body with life as a condition of disturbance. There is only the non-emptiness connected with the sixth sense base and dependent on this body with life as the condition. What is not present is understood as empty of what is not present. Whatever remains is understood as what is present. In what is seen, there is only the seen. In what is heard, there is only the heard. In what is cognized, there is only what is cognized. So, Ananda, this is final entry into emptiness, which is in accord with reality and is undistorted and pure. Ananda, whoever enters and remains in this emptiness, whether past, present, or future, they all enter into this same emptiness that is undistorted and pure, superior and unsurpassed. Therefore, Ananda, train yourself to enter into the same emptiness that is undistorted and pure, superior and unsurpassed. This is what the Buddha said, and Ananda was delighted in his words. That's the end of the sutta. Thank you. Isn't it marvelous that these words are still here? You heard me, I said this probably 100 times on retreat. And they're still so relevant to the problem of ignorance, the common problem that we've had since the beginning of human consciousness. And the path is direct, and it works. The only catch is we have to be willing to work through the aversion caused by our own ignorance. We have to be mindful of the hindrances and not let them stop us. Any questions about this sutta before we go around the room? You all got it? Mm-hmm. Can you see the useful application of this sutta?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Thank you. And that line that I keep referring to now, that be mindful of what's present and be mindful of what is not present, do you see that as the essence of the Buddha's teaching?
Yeah.
Because it really is that. And that can help us get focused, because when we're not like that, we'll recognize that our minds are simply distracted. And we're distracted because we want to hold on to everything and not let go of anything, not know what we should. We don't want to let go of what we should be abandoning to develop. Ron, good to see you tonight. Yeah, it did seem like we were going a lot longer than a few days.
Yes. I'm going to have to go over that last section a bit more. The beginning part is all pretty clear, although I have to stop myself from seeing it as a necessary sequence of things that everybody has to go through to, I don't think I want to go through that litany of perception of this and that and the other thing.
Thank you for referring to that. So the Buddha's describing something that was very common during his time, these teachings that hope to bring us through these dimensions, these different, and they really shouldn't be called dimensions because there's really nothing there. And these different applications of these dimensions are taught throughout modern Buddhism as something to attain to. And so the Buddha's not saying that we have to go through these. He's simply pointing out traps in the way.
Right.
And so if you're not chasing the perceptions, blah, 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 nothing of it, then you don't have to worry about it. In other words, you don't have to fabricate it yourself so you can follow the sequence. You're lucky if you know, as David was saying, you're lucky if you haven't developed this type of conditioning.
Right. I've always beaten myself up for because I've been around people that have got into this stuff. And I've always, beaten myself up for not getting.
Oh, I did too.
Yeah, finally realizing, man, I dodged a big bullet there because I would have gotten stuck into this.
You absolutely did. I did get stuck in it. And through my associations with different modern Buddhist practices. And I thought that they were so important because they were explained sometimes in very similar words to this, but as you need to understand this and develop it, and almost as a preliminary to developing the practice. And the Buddhist, again, he's saying this, remember, he always taught situationally because they believe that this was important. So he's simply telling them, all of these are fabricated states. There's nothing elevated about them. They're simply to be recognized that you're in them and let them go. That's all the value that there is. These elevated states are like a glob of foam. So if you haven't developed it or find yourself there, don't look for it. It's not necessary. What's necessary is to be mindful of what's present and not present. And Ram's a good example of that. What was not present in him was buying into these other beliefs. Yeah. Be mindful of what's not present. Thank you. Lorna.
I'll sit in noble silence.
We're glad you're here tonight. Kevin, good to see you.
See you, Joe. Thank you for giving this talk, and thank you for a wonderful retreat. A couple of the things that sort of were very clear in this is when he says this is in accord with reality, undisturbed and pure, and it seems that maybe, I don't know if it's correct or not, but this example of all these other practices or what he's describing, these other concepts, it's not in accord with reality, because in reality we have the interplay of the three marks of existence and those other sort of, what he's using here, these large grand scale things that he learned don't acknowledge that. So
yeah,
it's as if he's bringing you back to what is present, what is not present, is three marks of existence are present, and when you're emptying things, then that you're not filling anatta, or you're not attaching to what is not a self.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. Thank you. It's such an important point that I failed to develop. The only insight, useful insight that the Buddha taught, the only vipassana he taught, was to gain insight into the three marks of existence, because that's where the problem resides. And these other things are simply a distraction from putting your focus on gaining that type of insight. So, thank you. David, good to see you tonight.
I've been thinking about the five aggregates and the three defilements and the three marks, and trying to apply it to the hindrances and the ten fetters. And it struck me that here we start dependent origination with ignorance. On Tuesday, I'm done with ignorance. I can take care of everything. And I'm not quite sure how that works, because if you take care of the ignorance, you're done. But looking at the fetters, you go through this whole list of lower fetters, and there's 10 of them. Sometimes there's more.
Yeah.
But the very last one is ignorance. And it's all that, I've been thinking about emptying.
Mm-hmm.
And you get down to that last one, ignorance. And I guess that's the easiest one. Once you've done all this work with your practice, getting unbound to these fetters.
Yeah.
So that's how I've been thinking about it. What you just said was when my kids were talking to me about algebra. but the things I did hear was that refining your practice, refining the Eightfold Path, and that's what I heard out of all that. So.
Then it's a useful sutta, isn't it?
Yeah, that's useful.
Yeah, and it everything the Buddha taught was to get us back to that first link in the chain of dependent origination. And so at that point of understanding, awakening is just a breath away.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thought away. You know, when you get to it, when your mindfulness is refined to that point, and you recognize ignorance, and you can say, this is not me.
Mm-hmm.
The task is done. And it really, and not to simplify it, but it really is that simple. But as we know, for most of us, unless we're Kundana, and a few others, it takes a little bit more effort. So. Thank you. Mary Beth, good to see you tonight. How are you doing?
Good. I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah.
Sorry it's been so long.
Glad you're here.
Just taking it in.
Thank you. Helen, good to see you. We missed you on retreat.
Oh, thank you. I missed being there.
Did you get a picture of this?
I
of the opening shirt?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Thank you. couple of things in regard to the general, the sutta, and as it was discussed tonight, I am grateful that I have never gotten involved in any other. And so it's like, check, don't have to worry about that. And then the other is just talking about that whole, your image of the tube and the Me Tube.
That's Jen's, not mine.
Okay.
That's
Jen.
Brilliant.
Jen?
Yeah.
I think she's copyrighted that by Yeah, she's got a few. A few lines she could trademark. But I sort of think about it as if you only exist within your vision and your peripheral vision, and everything is within hand's reach, and that's how you determine, define, see the world, respond to the world as everything within your grasp.
Yeah.
And there's a whole world outside of that, and by living that way, you are just creating one loop after the other, after the other, after the other, and nothing goes beyond that, and that is its own distortion.
Yeah.
You know, right there, and you're missing a heck of a lot. But you know, after listening to this sutta, I am very grateful that I don't have all those things to be confused about.
Yeah, and you should be. That's even more difficult to work through, and what a beautiful picture grasping at this and that. And it's always unsatisfying, no matter what
never
we.
Never enough. It's like trying to pick up all the sand on the beach. It just keeps going through your fingers.
It's always an dukkha occurs when we're stuck in wrong view. Thank you, Mary. How are you? Good to see you.
Very good. Good to be here. Good to see everyone. I felt like my brain, my malleable brain, that probably has, you know, more capacity than, you know, we realize. I felt like that when I first read that and then hearing it, that it makes sense and that I understand the concept of recognizing what is and what is not. I couldn't articulate it back to you, but as, you know, something that's present in my brain as not a foreign object, it's there, right? So, you know, in my humble self, that made a lot of sense in, progression, I guess building off of some of the spaciousness and openness I feel as a result of the retreat. You know, like sometimes things can enter your brain because you are in the right place to hear them. So, but anyway, so that was a wonderful sutta. And then the other thing I wanted to say about what Jen was talking about too was that the Me Too, I believe, represented time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was a timeline.
Yes.
Yeah, so it was very linear, if that helps understand. Everybody can listen to it on the tape and hear her describe it herself. But it helped understand that we're living in this space, whether it's linear or this like circular thing that she described, but it's confined and not present now. This linear thing isn't making you available to now. It's making you think about the past and the future and, you know, other things on the timeline. And and one of the examples was how in there's no aging in the process. If you recall, you know,
Lorna brought that.
Pardon?
Lorna brought
that. Yes. That there's aging, sickness, death, you know, whatever. But in the present moment, there isn't any of that because that's all in the Me Too, you know, here or here, but it's not here. And that was all part of sort of where that conversation went. So I encourage everybody to listen to that I don't remember what day that was, but we'll just have to listen to it all then to find it. But it was very good conversation, and the contribution from Lorna and Jen was, you know, we all really felt it. That was great. So great retreat, great. This was, I don't think I could have understood this, even a couple weeks ago, so. Thank you very much.
Now you're ready. Thank you. And just to explain that a bit further, what Jen was referring to about the timeline is that ignorance requires a timeline.
Mm.
It cannot exist without that, without the establishment of past and future. And really, there's not much present in ignorance. And the Buddha refers to the Dhamma, you know, heard from. He discovered a timeless path. He's literally referring to a path that is outside of ignorance. And outside of ignorance, there really, literally is no time that is useful, except an awakened human being will still get to work on time. What Lorna was referring to, and I don't know if she doesn't want me to say it this way, but in her brilliance, an awakened human being with no self-referential views doesn't age because it's outside of the timeline of ignorance. It's simply present. And if it happens to be present at almost 63, it's just present. It's not, it's a little bit of a subtle concept, but it's not, I'm no longer carrying around 25, you know, when I could still run up hills. But I'm also not concerned about 85 or when the cow might get me. Simply present with what is. And so it doesn't have to be any different, because a wise human being understands that it can't be any different. So why fret over it? I mean, and that almost sounds too simplistic, but that's the essence of understanding eye making. It's a complete depersonalization of whatever's occurring. There's no aging to an awakened mind. Another reference to that would be it's called the deathless state. It's not because we're never going to die. It's because we freed ourselves from even that concern. There's no aging. And in that, there's no sickness. Even within sickness, even a sick person. You know how when you, and I think everybody feels the way, but maybe it's only me. When I have a cold, even if it's a relatively minor cold, I think I'm going to feel like that forever. And I can't wait till it's over with. Even though, you know, I've had enough experience to know that if I just hang on and have some vitamin C and et cetera, in a few days it's gone. But when you're sick, you feel like it's forever. When you understand sickness, aging, and death, it's just another aspect of what's occurring. And it doesn't need to be any different. Why? Because it can't be any different. It's what's occurring. Thank you. Greg, good to see you again. How have you been?
Good to see you, John. Very well.
Good.
It's not that I have nothing to say. It's that I think I have so much to say. I'm just going to email you.
I look forward to the email. Thank you. But you really need to share it with the Sangha too. Diane, good to see you.
Thank you
for being my Uber.
I don't know why my mind works the way it does, but one of the things I keep, and I have done this for years since I've been coming to these, is how would you teach a child this?
Oh, I have, but yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm not asking you.
Oh, okay.
I'm not done yet. Just a second.
It sounded like a direct question.
No. And I realize that it would be a wonderful thing to teach children early on, because so, you know, all of this Me Too that I imagine you're talking about has been built up from parental, school, you know, sisters, you know, siblings, I mean, a lot of television, you know, everything, the inundation of the ignorance. And so the main thing that I was have been thinking through all of this is the profound, I guess, the profoundness of the Buddha to keep reminding us to be gentle with ourselves. Because propensity to blame and, you know, have a pity party because I'm not getting it, or I, you know, did all this karma stuff wrong and all that stuff. To be gentle, I mean, going through that and releasing it and letting it go and putting it out of our minds, I mean, that is, I take another gift
mm-hmm.
of what is the present moment is, when you're in the present moment, you can't blame anyone, that's not part of the what's happening now. And the gentleness, I am so glad for that gentleness, because I have such a, you know, ego thing that beats me up all the time. And it's a long time learning to be gentle. That's it.
Thank you, Diane. Yes, it is. That you started with that question, so I'm going to answer it.
Oh, no.
I've been fortunate that I've had a few younger people. I think the youngest was 12. A few were around 14 or 15, and they kind of understood it. But I usually start with right speech and a very simple, you know, I usually ask the question, did you ever notice when you're with your friends and you're talking about someone who's not there and you might be not so kind, how it makes you feel? And you don't feel so great, and most kids will recognize that, and they'll say, yeah. And I said, and then I'll get into, not a long explanation of right speech, but the point is to be mindful of that, and then I'll teach them a little meditation so you can strengthen your concentration and be aware of it. But a good explanation, this is whether you're talking to a child or just are you explaining what you're doing, is that you're learning a way to not take things so personal and a way to develop a peaceful mind. And that's really the Dhamma, isn't it? And it's a way that is not threatening to most people, and it's an easy introduction to what you're doing. And then if there's some interest, you can get a little bit further and tell them that you know meditation is part of it, and learning some tools to not take things so personal. And that really is a useful explanation of the Dhamma. So. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm here. I'm gonna pass tonight.
Glad you're here. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you too. I think anything I was going to comment has already been said. I would just encourage people to listen to the recordings of the retreat, because there were several people that had some major insights into this. It was a, I was telling Helen, it was a Sudapalooza.
sounds like a Bollywood weekend.
John would say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to try to get in, and he would list six suttas, and then he would say, but if there's a problem with it, I can probably leave this one out. And we just sat there going, oh. So it was a lot of information, just like tonight feels like a lot of information. But if you sort of relax into it and understand that really what's being said is that there is this whole other part of our lives that's being lived outside this linear tube of self-defense and ignorance and everything else that we call our daily lives. And I think that in itself sends me into a state of curiosity to see what's possible outside the me tube and something that can be more healthy and satisfying way to live.
And it
is. That's what encourages me, is the curiosity of what am I missing.
Yeah, and in a very skillful way, you're curious about what's present and what's not present.
You can see it in some moments when you decide you're in a situation that you might usually get defensive about, and you just sit in silence, or you don't respond in the same kind of knee-jerk way of defending yourself. And and it's sort of like a breeze, that things just sort of pass by without interruption or disruption. And it does create a certain amount of spaciousness because you're not in that constricted space of selfness.
Yeah.
Of trying to defend yourself or justify something. It's this whole other thing that happens. That's all I have.
Thank you. I like that. It's a breeze. It's a cool breeze.
Yeah,
please, those that weren't on a retreat, please listen to the recordings, but those that were, I think it'll just take it deeper. I wasn't as judicious as I have been in the past with editing, meaning that there was just so much great discussion and great insight from everybody that was there that I left a lot of that in. I just couldn't see editing it out. The reason why I'm saying that is if you're listening to something and it's you personal, and you would rather it not be there, just please tell me and I'll take it out. But you know, there's...
You have to go back and listen.
If I were you, Liz, I would. Because you really said some whoppers. Again, I would be happy to remove it, but like I said on retreat, if just one of you wasn't there, it certainly wouldn't be the same. And if just one of your insightful comments wasn't there, it wouldn't be the same, and it wouldn't be. The sangha just came together so incredibly wonderfully on this retreat. So.
Well, the wild cookie party was not tape recorded, so we're all in the clear about
how
the
do you
Mario
know?
Mario Brothers and all
how
that
do
stuff.
You know? It wasn't. Russ, good to see you again. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Great.
Well, that was a lot. Thing that stuck with me is you kind of have to learn like what is all the bad stuff so that you can, I can empty myself of it. And then
yeah.
I have to learn what the good stuff is so I can fill myself with it. Mm-hmm. And then I might get somewhere.
Boy, yeah, you're going to have this seat next week because that's it.
Yeah, that's
pretty
good.
That's it. Thank you, Russ. What?
Anacadanda, is that how you pronounce it?
Anacadanda.
Oh, the Anattalakana Sutta?
No.
The Arahant Sutta?
Person.
Kandana.
The dude.
Oh, Kandana.
Kandana.
Oh.
Kandana. Yeah.
Yeah. And
hey,
just
John.
Yes, Greg.
I lied about the email. I'll ask you one clarification real quick.
Please.
Send me a stamp. So
you
emptiness, like, the way we talked about it today was basically emptiness of ignorance.
Yes.
And also not striving for any like jhana of the experience of emptiness, of like non being here. But
yeah, there's no jhana that's taught to do that. But,
right.
Yeah.
So not something to strive for. And that would be different though than emptiness when it's translated like sunyata or sunyata as empty of any like independently existing self, like in like the way we talk about anatta, like that would be empty of independent.
Yep.
Like that emptiness is empty in a different context? Like is
no.
It two different types of emptiness almost?
Not within the Buddhist teaching. That even that, and you're using that word anatta as it's commonly used to describe in non-self, implying that there's no such thing as a self, is a wrong view. And it has nothing to do with how the Buddha teaches emptiness. So again, one word can have two completely different meanings. So the Buddha didn't teach emptiness as an environment to establish ourselves in. He used, and it was a common term during his time, much like he used karma in a different, completely different way. He used a common term, emptiness, or sunyata, same thing, to describe something completely different than what people had believed it to be. So it literally is two different things. It has nothing to do with an environment, has nothing to do with self-annihilation. It has to do with understanding the point of the Dhamma, to empty oneself of ignorance, to become empty of clinging. And there is no other application within the Buddha's teachings. Because when you look at it at its most subtle form, those other applications are seeking a way to reconcile itself in some realm, and now this realm is the realm of nothingness or the realm of emptiness. And so we all, there's no such thing as a self, and yet we all exist in this realm of emptiness. There's a huge contradiction right there. And it's something that I lived with for a long time that made me very uneasy. How could this be? It doesn't make sense. But great teachers were telling me this is so, and so I went along with it. Until I came across the Kula or the Mahasamatha Sutta, and wait a minute, this has nothing to do with what I've been taught. How can this be? And I couldn't understand that. And honestly, it took me quite a few years to put these pieces together until I understood the context that the Buddha taught, meaning dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, because then you can understand the Buddha's application of emptiness. So I hope that helps you.
Yeah, I got to get beyond. I spent too much time with Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu and Sangha and that whole idea of relation to dependent origination as nothing, as almost a metaphysical type of ground of non-being.
I've mentioned Nagarjuna. Yeah, it's not. I mentioned Nagarjuna a few times simply because I was well aware of him. I read a lot of his books, and they were fascinating. But I didn't realize why, because they instilled such grasping in me to understand these concepts. And Nagarjuna was a great teacher, 5th or 6th century. He recognized as one of the great teachers of modern Buddhism, and his whole thing was to reconcile what we just talked about. Reconcile nothingness and not nothingness. In fact, one of his great quotes, I can't remember what it is, and he gets into this deep swirling soup of simply saying that everything exists and everything doesn't exist, and that's the highest thought. And okay, but what does that do for me? How does that help me as a human being, which is what the Buddha was and what he hoped to teach, was how to thrive as a human life. He wasn't concerned, and he never said that these other things don't exist, but he always and consistently discounted them as irrelevant to the goal. What was the Buddha's goal? Understanding and abandoning ignorant views. That's all he was concerned about, because he understood that the end result of that was a calm and peaceful mind. So again, thank you for bringing it up, but I hope to get an email from you soon anyway on any subject. Thank you. Please.
Just the other thing from all of this is, you know, in the conversation of what it is and what it isn't, you know, what should be in your bowl, not in your bowl, having to do with emptiness. You know, one of the things that I took away also from the retreat and just even more recently, that if right effort and right intention isn't there, that and if we're just coming here, and here, meaning right here, is the primary essence of a practice, then there's more there to be done, right? That there's a significant integration that needs to take place that reflects in your effort and your intention every day. In your, you know, there's an opportunity to prepare more for here, and you know, I know David talked about that. The investment in yourself to fully integrate this in a bigger way than, because this is not a meditation practice. This is a life practice.
It's an eightfold path practice.
Pardon?
It's an eightfold path practice.
And supported by meditation and supported by a Tuesday night or Saturday or whatever. But that's only a piece of it. That there's more that can be done by each of us to invest fully in the practice.
Mm-hmm. Boy, well said. And David is such a good example, such a great example of wholehearted engagement with the Dhamma and the results of that. But of course, we all engage with the Dhamma as we can. Again, the Dhamma meets us where we are too. But it also includes those guidelines of right intention and right effort if you want to develop it. So a little bit of explanation of why, again, I've talked about this before, but we've experienced it, and there's some people here tonight that weren't on this past retreat. I do pack a lot of Dhamma in our retreats. In fact, I think it was 12 suttas over 3.5 days. I can't believe my head didn't explode, but it didn't. And it's remarkable that you were able to stay with me, but that's not really what I want to say. The reason why I do that, and I said at the beginning of our retreat, and it's in the little booklet, is to me, retreats aren't retreats from the Dhamma, the retreats from the world and into the Dhamma. And Laura and I had a great conversation about this on the way home. And so that 3.5 days should not and is not a vacation. It's certainly not an overemphasis on getting away from our life and just and escaping it. We mindfully leave the world behind and enter into the Dhamma as best as we can. And so the 12 suttas are not meant to, that each and every one of those suttas should be completely integrated and understood in those 3.5 days. That's impossible. But what you find is that by exposing yourself over and over again to the words of the Buddha and as important, our own discussion within that Sangha, it has an effect at some other point. And if we're going to learn something, we first have to expose ourselves to it, and then we can start integrating it. And so a retreat in that sense, you know, to me, again, I'm not putting it down, as far as the Dhamma is concerned, a silent retreat is simply a waste of time. There might be other benefits that you'd have from it, but as far as learning the Dhamma, how could you? And this way, it's not meant that you will gain full understanding over 3.5 days, but you will now have integrated, embedded, maybe a more modern word, of what you can now develop come Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and through the rest of your life. You have a much stronger foundation, whether you even realize it or not, because you sat there and you were present for it. This is another way that we learn, isn't it? But even you didn't just listen to the words of the Buddha, you didn't just listen to my words, did you? You listened to each other. One of the most remarkable things was Kevin's question about this conversation he was having with Jen. On retreat, after all that, Kevin and Jen could have been talking about anything if their minds weren't well framed. But they were talking about the finer points of dependent origination. That's how it works. And so now, off our retreat, or those that weren't on our retreat, you've heard another piece to the puzzle. I don't know that I completely understand what I read tonight, but I know that it's deepening my understanding of what the Buddha taught, and I can draw on it when it's appropriate. So almost every one of you have had a situation where something's come up and you were able to draw on an aspect of the Dhamma, and it brought you back into the present moment. That's how it works. And it's for most of us, unless we are Kandana, it's a gradual development. But in order for us to gradually develop towards awakening, we have to understand what an awakened human being taught. And how do we do that? We listen to it. So maybe the retreats are too much, but I can tell you after 6 retreats, and also my experience with many other types of retreats, it's not too much. But again, if you want a relaxing weekend, you know, there's always a cabin in the woods. And I'm not trying to be smart at all. If you want to really immerse yourself in the Dhamma, come to one of these retreats and you will.
John, the aspect of sitting with all that information sort of coming at you, there's a certain point where you can kind of say, I don't totally understand this now. If I listen a little longer, I might start to understand it, or even just letting it kind of wash over you, where you recognize pieces and parts to the structure of how this all works. So it can feel a little overwhelming, but it does build up individual, it builds progress. It sort of builds an understanding to the links and how everything kind of works together.
Yeah, and it really is the only way to develop it. I think part of the stress, and again, this is speculation on my part, but I do understand conditioned thinking, is we've all been part of this model that there's going to be a test after. We learned it in school, didn't we? And so there's not going to be any test. The only test is within yourself. Is it working? And if it's not working, but you believe that an awakened human being's teaching, that will help you redouble your efforts. You know, it'll remind you, come back to class, and it'll remind you that you know, a good sit twice a day is part of the practice, but it's not the only part. You know, there's more to it. And most of us would like the quick fix. We'd like the idea that I can come to a meditation class once a week and sit for a little bit and listen to that old fool Babylon, and that's going to be enough. But it's not nearly enough, is it?
No.
Or and the other model that I use is the Buddha meditated a lot, from what I can tell, probably twice a day, maybe three times. You know, sometimes there was an afternoon sit during the Sangha. But he spent in a proportionately larger amount of time teaching than he or the other monks and nuns did sitting. And that's as it should be. It's one factor of eight. It's not the only factor. Mm-hmm. And if we don't integrate the entire Eightfold Path through exposure and repetition and remembrance, mindfulness, we'll never get there. But if we do, we can move through it rather rapidly, like we've experienced here in the Sangha. So, I think two announcements I want to make. See you, Mary Beth. It's so good to see you.
See you.
We got to talk about things going on down there, so I'll be in touch with you at the center. July 9th, most of us know there's that concert up there by the Four Nations Ensemble. If you want to go.
June?
What did I say? Yeah, June 9th, in a couple Saturdays. There's a flyer out there, info in the emails, etc., link to the website. So if you want, you know, I'm looking forward to it.
As a day trip or an overnight?
As what Lorna pointed out, which I don't know that I thought about too clearly, but it is a 3-hour ride up and back, so
yeah.
It's a long
day trip.
We could, you know, I mean, there's facilities there if you wanted to stay over. I just think it's going to be a really wonderful day, and it's great support for Juan Dharma Center, but I also understand it is a long day on the road. But if you do want to go, let me know, and we'll organize it. My thinking was that we'd meet here after a Saturday class and just head up, and they did say that they'll have lunch for us, and et cetera, et cetera. The other thing, I've mentioned it a few times, but please let me mention it once more. If you haven't reviewed my book, Becoming Buddha, and you'd like to, I hope you'd like to, please do so, because I think most of you know that it is important stuff to get out there, and I could use it for a few more bucks, too. So.
And there's two more volumes coming out. Is that what we've decided?
Yeah, there may be. Well, there's at least a revised edition. Somebody mentioned, Kevin, that maybe it's multi-volumes, and I'm thinking about that. But again, like I run my retreats, I just think it's important to have it all like in one nice little package. But
have you ever seen the movie Julia and Julia?
I did, but I don't remember. I remember.
But part of it is Julia Child's process of making her volumes. For the first time ever, putting French cooking so that an American could understand it. And the criticism throughout, or the challenge throughout, was it became voluminous.
Yeah.
And it ended up being multiple volumes, but she stuck to her guns, and multiple volumes it is. So.
Yeah, and again, I'm now that Kevin had to bring that up, I'm thinking more and more about it, but also, to me, the only convenience is it's a lighter book. You know, it's easier to handle, but. I don't know. I think I will bring this up because I could really value your input. In my mind, it looks like there's going to be another 200 or so pages, which makes it about a million page book. So.
It depends on the structure. You know? If it's stuff that can even be split into volumes. Or not.
Well, that's my conundrum.
Yeah.
Can I and still maintain the integrity of the Dhamma? My underlying thinking is if it is a large volume, which obviously it is, it already is, it might just be that's what's present, and it's the best way to present it. When you compare that to the Pali Canon, it's a pocketbook, you know. So we'll see, but I appreciate your input.
Do you sell many Kindle editions? I mean, which way do you sell most?
It's about equally.
Because to a Kindle it makes another thing.
Yeah, to a Kindle it doesn't. And yeah, I mean, that's the answer. And in fact, I do know that some people buy, maybe this is telling you, some people buy the larger volume and then they buy the Kindle. But that's one of the, you know, the nice things about publishing in 2018. You get, if you buy the book, I think it's $2, for $2 more you get the Kindle version. So if you have a Kindle, that's the way to go. You know, the other thing is it has 12 point print, and it's recommended that it should be 10 to 12 points, but most books are published at 10 points,
right.
Simply because, guess what?
More
it's smaller
pages.
And there's less pages and et cetera. But I'm a little bit sensitive to people that need larger print.
Right.
I, honestly, like 12 point doesn't work for me anymore. But I mean, that's one of the decisions I made. I don't know if I went back to 10 point, I think I saved like 85 pages. I don't know, we'll see. But thank you for your input. And as I put the book together, the revised edition, and get to a number of pages, I'll ask you again what you think, if I should split it up or not. I may not listen to you, but I always, and you know, the other thing we kind of decided on is establishing a board of directors. I think that's just a wonderful idea that we can do to kind of ensure continuity about what's going on here. What's going on here is really astonishing and wonderful. So, again, just to beat out that horse, please give me an outstanding review on Amazon. We'll finish with the Metta Sutta.
And you mean on Amazon, right?
Yeah. I think there's links on the website and maybe even in the newsletters about how to go to that page directly.
Right.
But thank you. And I won't mention it again. I don't mean to beat you up over it. So let's find our relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. Become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the words of the Buddha from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. And by the way, thank you all for that wonderful gift at the end of the retreat, too. Greatly appreciated. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.